On this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, recorded live during the California Association of Surgery Centers 2019 annual conference in Monterey, California, we talk about the various sessions during one of the nation's largest conferences, and also we do a focus segment with our friend Gregory Tertes, a registered pharmacist, about drug shortages.
Welcome to the ASC Podcast with John Gailey, a podcast for anyone interested in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry. This episode is sponsored by Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies. The ASC regulatory environment is increasingly challenging, but organizations that outsource their regulatory oversight to Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies have an edge. AHS works with ASCs to oversee their quality improvement, risk management, emergency and infection control programs, run their meetings, develop education programs, and always be prepared for surveys.
Welcome to episode 65 of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey for September 9th, 2019. We're recording from Monterey, California, with post-production in our studios in Spenceport, New York, and Columbus, Ohio. This is Sue Cronkite, Senior Nurse Consultant with AHS, and I'm here with John Gailey, the owner of Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies and one of the leading experts in the freestanding ambulatory surgery industry, and the author and co-author of over 10 books about the ASC industry, including the Survey Guide for ASCs. John speaks frequently at both national and state ASC meetings on a wide variety of topics.
So I bet we just confused people with where we are recording.
We're everywhere.
So the story here is that we recorded our episode live from California, but we've been on the road so much that we haven't been able to do post-production. Mm-hmm. So, and now we are in the...
At the Ohio State
Association in our special studio here, finishing the post-production stuff. And then we did a little bit of work in our studio in Rochester and Spenceport. Yep. I bet it was a little bit confusing. So it was fun. We spent a whole week out on the West Coast with our friends at CASA. We just had a disagreement as to whether we call it CASA or CASA. Because we're from Western New York, we call it CASA. We have to pronounce that A. Just like quappy instead of quappy.
No, it's quappy. I am sticking with that.
Sue and I took a couple days in Newport Beach, and we have a place out there. We had a wonderful luau and spent some time in the sun and relaxing, mm-hmm. and then hopped in a plane and came back to Spencerport.
Yes.
It was, our employees think we take too much time off. Have you noticed that? They don't think we work very hard.
Yes, but that was a conference, so we were learning and we were podcasting. And
it was a fantastic conference.
It was very good.
I'd never been to Monterey, and I know you hadn't either, and we just really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. But we had some problems because I like leaving the door open.
Well, I opened it because, you were off doing something, and I opened the door to kind of step out on the balcony, and there was this loud noise. It was the sea lions. They were just... I won't make the sound here because it sounds silly, but...
All night long.
Yeah. Well, yes, I had to get up and close the door after a bit, but it was kind of neat. And then we walked down to the water and there were seals swimming around in the harbor, and that was really beautiful.
They were very loud. Nice. They had a lot to say.
So. Yes.
So the sessions in the California Association meeting were incredible. As a matter of fact, unfortunately, I don't think we attend a single one.
We didn't.
Because we were so busy recording.
Yes, they're very good about... having a lot of people there that were interested in talking on the podcast. So we were very busy.
So we interviewed one of our friends, Greg Tertes, who is from California. He's a pharmacist out in California. And we interviewed him. We're going to do a focus segment on him. And I thought we would just talk a little bit about some of the sessions that we did not attend, but that we did get to speak to the speakers about. And we recorded. So we have a bunch of episodes coming up with a number of those speakers to kind of discuss the issues that we discussed during that meeting. Yes. So one of the speakers was Bill Prentice, who's the Chief Executive Officer of the ASC Association. And Bill is actually going to be an upcoming episode. He talked about the 2020 payment update and kind of the surprises that we had with the payment update. He's also talked about a number of things going on with the association. So he did a session there on the regulatory environment, and he was with a speaker from the state association that talked about various state issues. And we are going to have a special episode also for the California Association, which we're recording shortly after we record this one. So that'll be for people from the state of California or anybody interested in what's going on in California. But Bill had a lot to say about what's going on at the federal level, which, as we talked about in a previous episode, fortunately, it was a relatively quiet year when it comes to the 2020 payment rule. Not a lot of changes, no real major surprises with regard to either the payment rule or really the Medicare quality reporting requirements. Then they had a, so we're just going to talk about some of the sessions that were kind of really highlighted during the thing and that we were able to interview the speakers there. My dear friend, Bob Zaza, who Bob and I go way back, I mean, years, like 20 years. And he is the president and CEO of Ambulatory Systems Development. He and Trey Parsons, who is an RN also with Ambulatory Systems Development, talked about expanding revenue in the ASC and how to increase profit. So he did a great session. He, and as I said, he's going to be in an upcoming episode here. Talked about adding new service lines and, you know, how you turn it into an excellent opportunity to expand, you know, your revenue base. So the goal behind his session and what he tried to do is try to educate participants on how you don't just jump into developing a new service line. You take it very carefully and that you're well prepared for it. You make sure that you're going to make money doing it.
Just kind of really think about what makes sense for you and your particular center to be profitable.
Yeah, it was a wonderful session. I didn't actually listen to it, but he, he gave us you know, an overview of what he spoke about during that session. So stay tuned for another episode about that. But I think that the real takeaway from that is, you know, be well prepared. Don't just jump into it. And another thing that we talked about is making sure that you don't jump into something like this based upon a vendor's assessment of how well you can do financially. You know, vendors have a vested interest in selling you a product. And while they can give you a lot of good information about starting a new product line, they should never be relied on. And then the second thing we talked about too in there is being very careful about what physicians promise they're going to bring, because it never really seems that they bring all of those cases or that volume that they say they will.
Yeah, kind of do your own research.
Right, exactly. Then we had a chance to talk to Ann Chimick. Now, Ann is an independent consultant. She used to be with one of the major publicly held companies there, and she's an MSN RN. She talked about quality and safety and the patient experience. Her session was entitled, How Improving Your Facility's Culture and Employee Engagement Drives These Three Areas. It was an interactive session which discussed, you know, what is really the cornerstone of every ASC when it comes to developing a culture of quality, a culture of safety.
It's things that we've talked about before, and it's a really great topic, just making sure everybody feels free to speak up, feels that their opinion is valued, that the administrator, you know, anybody in leadership will take it seriously, no matter who it is that speaks up. They're willing to listen because often they're the ones that might catch something.
Right. And how do you develop that culture? How do you work with your employees to make them feel like they're part of a team, that they're willing to step up, and that they start thinking about quality all the time, that they participate in the quality improvement activities, hopefully participate in the quality improvement plan, that they are looked upon as valued input to what's going on in the quality improvement process.
And on Friday morning, you were moderating a special panel on quality and safety in the ASC called Telling the ASC Story. And I thought that went really well.
It was, if I may say so myself. Of course, I was just the moderator. I actually, you know, just try to bring these people together to tell the story. And this was an idea from Beth LeBoyer, who is the executive director, who put together this incredible panel of three people from various aspects of the industry. And I really have to, you know, reach out and kind of point out what a great idea Beth had here. So the concept here is that ASCs are being scrutinized by the media and payers and the employer community regarding their safety and outcomes. And what we really wanted to ask is, how can ASCs successfully respond to questions and their patients' concerns? So the panel addressed the current programs for evaluating ASC outcomes, their findings, and how ASCs can utilize the various products that are available for the benefit of the industry and for their own ASC. So we had three panelists, Missy Danforth, who is with Leapfrog Group. And Missy comes from an interesting background in that Leapfrog Group is it's a nonprofit that is basically sponsored by major employers throughout the country. Mm-hmm. And what they do as part of that is they provide information about the quality in the hospital industry. And now they've, you know, moved into the ASC industry and are very excited about that. So Missy was on the panel to talk about how we utilize information, how we get information mm-hmm. as ASCs, you know, to groups like LeapFrog, and how then they utilize that information to get the message out. And a big part of her discussion was, how do you get the message to the public?
Yes.
Not just the employer groups, but how do the people that are actually going to get the surgery mm-hmm. Get that information? And I thought she did a fantastic job. Michael Larson was another speaker. He was with Municipalities, Colleges, Schools, and Insurance Group, MCSIG. And he spoke from the employer standpoint. How do employers look at ambulatory surgery centers? How do they partner with ambulatory surgery centers to bring the average cost, you know, of doing surgery down? A huge part of his discussion was not only the price, and as interesting, I think you thought it was interesting too, that he wasn't talking about money the whole time. Mm-hmm. He was talking about quality, and that his experience with the ambulatory surgery industry was that employers not only save money, but had better outcomes
yes.
as a result of working with ambulatory surgery centers. So one of the questions that I asked as part of the panel is, you know, how do the small guys get into it? You know, mm-hmm. a lot of, more than half of the industry is made up of small ambulatory surgery centers who don't band together necessarily with other providers to, you know, get the attention of these large employer groups. So he had a little bit of advice on that. And then we brought Ann Chimick on, who is an independent consultant. Ann comes from the provider standpoint. In other words, you know, what do we do? How do we develop quality programs that can produce results that we want, that we're proud of? Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all proud of what we produce, but how do we get that information out? You know, what do we do with regard to external benchmarking? How do we use information that we submit to benchmarking organizations to improve the quality of the care that we're providing in the ambulatory surgery center? And how do we get that message across to all the people that need to know it, including the patients?
Mm-hmm. That seemed to be a big overriding theme of all of this. We have all of this data that we gather. And how do you put that together to be meaningful and to show how well you're doing or show what you might change?
Right. And, you know, we know that we provide great quality care. Mm-hmm. We know that we spend a lot of time preparing for surveys, preparing, you know, doing quality improvement. Sometimes we lose our focus while we're doing this because we're so busy doing the surgery, and that we look upon the quality improvement process as something that we have to do because we're going to have a survey.
Yes.
And it's a requirement, but that's not the main reason we do it. And, you know, high quality providers, of course, take that information and use it to improve the quality in their organization, and they use it in order to sell their service to, you know, to the patients, to the physicians, and to the community as a whole. So it was a great session, and unfortunately, we were not able to bring all of those speakers together for a presentation here. We couldn't get them all in the room at the same time. So we interviewed Missy and Ann for future episodes here about their respective areas. So our listeners will be able to get a good perspective as we go over the. We have enough material probably for about four episodes moving on. So I just really appreciate it. It was really a great conference, and California always does a great job. It really is one of the best conferences nationally. So we are going to have a special episode for California members where we interview Beth,
the board members,
and one of the board members there, as well as have a little interview with or a part of an interview with Bill Prentice. Mm-hmm. And as I said, we're going to have Bill on a future episode for everybody
yes.
About the various things that they're talking about. Let's take a short break and we'll come back and talk to our friend Greg Tertez about drug shortages.
So while we were in California, we talked to our friend Gregory Tertez about drug shortages. And as everybody knows, they're still an ongoing issue and they are likely to continue.
So he really didn't give us a lot of hope that this is going to go away.
Yeah, but he gave us a lot of good information about why they happen.
Right.
Some ideas of how to be prepared and how to deal with them, how to specifically kind of show if you have been keeping track of everything. And how to deal with expired drugs on the medication card. So it was pretty informative.
It was. And so Greg is a registered pharmacist. He's a consultant pharmacist with ASC Pharmacist Consultants based out of California, but he does cover mm-hmm. some other states too. So let's listen to the interview.
John and I are here with Gregory Turdes, the pharmacy consultant with ASC Pharmacist Consultants Incorporated.
So, Greg, thank you for being on our podcast. We've actually referred to you a couple times in previous podcasts with some of the advice that you've given to us and corrections to some of the information that we put out there. As we say, we're not perfect, and every once in a while we get things slightly wrong. So, thank you very much. But we're out here in California. We're in your backyard here in Monterey. And thought we would talk a little bit today about drug shortages, which is a kind of a hot topic. So first of all, tell us why they happen in the first place.
Well, John, as you know, I'm a fan of your podcast.
Thank you.
I do get to listen to it on my long drives between clients, so I do try to keep up with that. I'm always interested in learning new things, even when they expand beyond pharmacy. So
yeah.
I certainly appreciate you doing the podcast. And medication shortages, came up for me particularly because of the hurricane going on in the East Coast. Not only am I thinking about what's happening for the people there, but also what happened in Puerto Rico a few years ago, and suddenly we couldn't get, normal saline. And so, salt water, you think it shouldn't be so hard to make, but hey, making it sterile and safe for us to use as an IV, it certainly can be. So things like that sometimes happen, and they knock out our supply chain. Also, the ingredients that are used in our IV solutions. I have an example of magnesium sulfate. It's used in construction, agriculture, food, drugs, cosmetics, leather, mining, metal anodizing, pulp and paper making, textiles, plastic. There's competition for these ingredients throughout the world. And we're no longer the supply chain used to be very U.S. focused.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And now it's a world supply chain. And if someone else starts using up one of our core ingredients for one drug, suddenly we can't get it here.
Okay.
There's also the FDA has been ramping up its regulation or its supervision. So there are two things that's happening for. One is manufacturing plants are being inspected more. And that includes the worldwide manufacturing plants. So India, China, other sites that make drugs for the U.S., go back two decades and those weren't being inspected. They were expected to be following good manufacturing practices, but the FDA teams didn't inspect them. Now they do.
So we're glad they're doing that, but sometimes places get shut down then.
If they are not following good manufacturing practices, they shouldn't be putting drugs into the U.S. market.
Right.
But when that happens,
then we
run into troubles.
Right.
Then also drugs that were invented before the FDA existed or before the FDA had the safe and effective. Originally, they were just effective, required proving effectiveness. So those drugs like neostigmine, atropine, phenylephrine, those are old drugs, and they did not have safe and effective proof. So neostigmine, I don't know, I'm terrible with time, but you go back 5 years, neostigmine cost us $10 a vial. Then it disappeared. It went on back order. And that was because it was during the transition from the non-patented to the re-patented. And they get patent protection again because a manufacturer went through the process of proving it safe and effective. And now it costs us $65 a vial.
Oh,
so not only did it go on shortage during that transition, but also it got more expensive when it did get approval.
Right.
And so that's one explanation that's a little opaque to a lot of people.
Yeah.
And then also there's consolidation. We live in a capitalistic society, and these manufacturers are big business, and they might focus more on a more profitable brand name drug than a generic drug. They might have scheduled a drug to be manufactured at a certain time in their plant. It's going to be manufactured in February. But then another manufacturer goes on back order or has a recall. Now that supply that should have lasted till February needs to be made in December, and they don't have that flexibility to do that. Their source materials haven't come in yet. Their vials haven't been made yet. Their labels haven't been printed yet. Who knows what? But they can't just play flexibility with that. And we don't have a backup system in the U.S. And so, my personal opinion, healthcare is not the best for pure capitalism. We need to invest in a secondary system, but that doesn't exist right now.
Right. And pharmacy is big business. Drugs are big business. Mm-hmm. So you're going to find this consolidation and continue, and just as we are, you know, in the provider market too. Mm-hmm. In order to be able to survive, you have to become more cost efficient. And of course, in the case of drug manufacturers, drive those profits for, you know, the public market there.
And I was actually just reading about heparin. Mm-hmm. So heparin is derived from, I just learned this, from pig intestines. Yeah. Oh. And they're, because of swine flu in China, they had to slaughter millions of pigs. And most of the pig intestines used for heparin development comes from that. Although they can source a worldwide source, they're expecting shortages of heparin.
Yeah.
Well, that's good for our audience, because we know we have a lot of vascular access doctors and facilities on that are listeners, and that, of course, is a growing field for the ASC market.
So I just read that it was either this week or last week. So it's a prediction.
Okay.
And, you know, the manufacturers know what's happening, so maybe they'll be able to adapt. But maybe they won't. So we need to be prepared.
So now what we've just done is all of our listeners of this podcast are going to go out and buy all of the existing supplies.
Yep.
Another benefit of listening to the podcast.
Well, we'll address hoarding in a moment, if that's okay.
That's a good idea. So obviously, we're all running into these challenges of dealing with the recalls and the shortages. Mm-hmm. How do we prepare for this? How can we make sure that we avoid, you know, catastrophically having to shut down our center?
Yeah, I talk about being organized. I always talk about being organized. I live in a black and white world where everything needs to be organized and checklists and all of that. And so I work with nurses who are responsible for ordering, and sometimes it's supply chain people that are responsible for ordering. And so I talk about having a systematic plan in place for shortages. One, it's really good if you know your usage of your medications. Mm-hmm. You know, there are centers that run, they keep a week supply of drugs. Most of my centers probably are, a lot of their regular use drugs, they have a month supply of drugs in stock. And that's usually to give them the flexibility, because they don't order every day or even every week sometimes. But so I recommend checking the drug shortages website. It's ashp.org/shortages.
Okay.
They update daily. They updated dextrose 50%, which is we're having problems with right now. That was updated 2 days ago.
Okay.
So we can see, it gives you what manufacturers make it, what the problem is, or what their explained reasoning is, and it gives you an idea of when it should be back. It also tells you the secrets of which ones are still available. So it's a good website. You know, I don't always advocate products, but man, that's a free one. That's a great resource out there.
Yeah.
And I recommend people keep a running list of the drugs that are on back order for them. And I recommend it for two reasons. One, so we don't forget one. I definitely had examples where ranitidine went on back order. And so everyone moved over to famotidine. These are two H2 antagonists to protect our stomach. Famotidine is a refrigerated med. That means when it comes out of the refrigerator, it has a beyond use date of 7 days. So it shouldn't just be in the anesthesia cart. So it's harder to use. They're pretty much therapeutically equivalent. So the ranitidine was on back order for about 3 months. And then I start going to centers that still are using famotidine. I said, oh, are you going to switch back to ranitidine? They said, what's ranitidine? Because they didn't have it on a list anywhere to remember to go to. It's a little bit less expensive, but certainly easier to use because it can be on the anesthesia cart. So, you know, so they didn't have a system. But then, you know, what about something that's on back order for 9 months, a year? We need to be continuously looking for these drugs to replace them, put them back into our system.
Well, and that brings up an interesting topic. Not all states require that you have a pharmacy consultant. And yet we as consultants ourselves advise every center that we go to, no matter what state or what the requirements are, they have a pharmacy consultant. So when you run into a drug shortage, who's the first person you should be calling?
Yeah, a nice lob there.
That's the point. Is that, you know, the pharmacy consultants are a resource for this, and
absolutely.
I'm not trying to build up your ego here, anyway.
Well, part of the solution is are there alternatives?
Right.
Definitely, when ranitidine went on back order, I got some calls saying, "Hey, what can we use?" And it was a really easy answer, saying to bring in famotidine.
Right.
When Zofran went on back order, I had a couple alternatives, and you know, there wasn't an exact replacement. But sure, here's some options.
Yeah.
How do you want to go with that?
Well, yeah. I think my point being is that we don't have to rely on the doctors all the time. And they're wonderful. They do a great job of what they're doing, but they're not always on top of all the drugs that are out there. And of course, they rely on pharmacists such as yourself mm-hmm. to, you know, give them advice on what alternatives might be out there, or how you might be able to get through that shortage.
Yeah, because even if you're switching to something else, you can give that advice of, are there other concerns you have to have with it, like you said, right, with the refrigeration, or does it, you know, not mix well with some other medications you're using a lot? I think it's just right. really important.
You know, the takeaway here is you're not on your own when you get into these drug shortages.
I advocate my clients are never on their own. They should reach out to their pharmacist consultant. So this list, it serves two purposes. One, it keeps those shortages top of mind, mm-hmm. but also when a surveyor comes, you keep those lists. You don't throw them away. That's why I advocate not using a post-it note.
Right. Yeah.
You don't throw them away. You put them in a file. So then when the surveyor comes, they say, you know, they bump into a shortage drug or they're aware of them or they ask you, you say, of course I have a system. And you pull out your mm-hmm. sheets and you show them all the ones you've resolved and all the ones that you currently have going on. Mm-hmm. And they say, wow, you obviously are really taking care of your patients.
Yeah, it's a great idea.
Well, and I'm going to take it a step further is reporting in your quality improvement minutes. We like to have a whole pharmacy section in our quality improvement minutes where you report on things such as shortages, what the impact have been, what changes have you made. Some of those decisions, you know, like if you have to change the formulary, they have to go through quality improvement and the governing body anyway. So definitely make that very prominent in your quality improvement minutes as part of your process.
The next piece in this is having multiple vendors. Now, the day of having one wholesaler, those were good old days.
Right.
I got everything from my wholesaler and I just ordered and it came in. I remember those days. We don't have them anymore.
Right.
So having, you know, I call it having a deep bench. And sure, that's, you know, going to be some of the big ones. And then having some of your credentialed smaller ones. Mm-hmm. You know, here in California, I'm lucky that every wholesaler who ships into the state must be licensed by the state. Okay. So I can go and look up and make sure that the state has approved them. Mm-hmm. From anywhere in the country, they need to be licensed here. So that helps, makes it easy for me when a center says, hey, can I order from these guys? And, you know, they just called me. And, you know, we have to worry about counterfeit drugs, unfortunately. Sure. So we really have to make sure they're credentialed and licensed. So mm-hmm. That's easy for me, but also having a deep bench. And sometimes there are the ones out there that are, you know, scalpers or, you know, they buy from the big ones when they know it's going to go on shortage. And then they turn around and they sell it with a big, big, you know, putting a markup of a zero at the end.
Yeah.
But sometimes that's what we have to do. We prefer not to, and the more prepared we are, the less we have to do it. But we definitely want to have a deep bench and at least have people we can call to solve some of our problems.
Right. And at least gives you the option of you can start playing them off each other too when it comes to pricing if you know, when the shortages disappear down the road.
Yeah. And then, you know, if we are paying attention to drug shortages on the drugs that we know are short, having a larger day supply on hand. Now, that doesn't mean we want to hoard. That doesn't mean we want to have a back room with, you know, cases and cases and cases of those drugs.
Yeah.
But having 2 months instead of 1 month, having 3 weeks instead of 1 week, it's a reasonable thing to do. You know, so we don't want to hoard so that we take drugs out of the supply chain that are needed by others.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, we do want to make sure we have stock for ourselves.
And we have to be careful that we don't end up in a situation where we have to get rid of drugs because we bought too many and now the expiration date comes upon us. So.
Excellent point. And then I do have centers that borrow from each other.
Yeah.
And I understand that and I don't mind that so much. We do need to be careful of the Drug Quality and Security Act, which is the track and trace. Mm-hmm. So there is a pedigree. This is all to prevent counterfeit drugs, which have entered our system.
Mm-hmm.
But by law now, we must have the pedigree of each drug that is shipped to our center. Now, our wholesalers keep that online, and you would find if you ask your main wholesaler rep, there's a website you can go and look up the pedigree of every drug that's been shipped to you.
And by pedigree, you mean the trail from the manufacturer to the final user, correct?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, that is the pedigree. So then if you are not the final user and you are sending it to a center, you are supposed to, by law, go in and print that pedigree and send it along.
Okay.
Now, if you order from some of these smaller wholesalers, they will often print it and put it in your shipment, and you can take it out and see who they bought it from, and who they bought it from, and who they bought it from. And that's the exact same thing you are supposed to do. The other problem is then recalls. Our wholesalers are often the ones we rely on to tell us about drug recalls. But if we got a drug from someone other than our wholesaler, who's going to be responsible, or is there another system we use to check for recalls?
And I would imagine also those that supply the drugs, not only the ones that borrow it from somebody else, but those that are lending it or sending it to somebody else is also going to have some culpability there
on
the recall side.
I worry less about culpability as just keeping track.
Yeah,
I understand. But absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. So for me, that's a system to be prepared. So we're tracking it. We're looking out. We're watching drug shortages. We're keeping track of our personal the problems we're having in our center. Oh, and then we've got multiple people we can buy it from. So those are kind of our proactive plan. And then, you know, for me, it's make sure everybody knows what's going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So if I only have 12 vials or 4 vials of labetalol in the building, I don't want to put one in each anesthesia cart and let anesthesia just use it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're done.
Right.
Yeah.
But does anesthesia know? And, you know, I advocate, sure, send them an email. Great. Do any of us have time to really read every email we get?
Right.
And if you're an anesthesia provider, you practice in a lot of centers. So how are you going to remember which center that was?
Yeah.
Okay. So then I also, a lot of my centers have a whiteboard where they write the current problems on. Mm-hmm. So everybody knows.
Mm-hmm. And make sure everybody knows that they have to look at the whiteboard before they start the day.
And that's great. But there's 3 drugs on there. Once I go into the OR and I'm starting a case, is that top of mind? Maybe not.
Right.
So as I advocate a note in the cubby where the labetalol is.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Drug on shortage, doc, only open this if you really need to.
Very good.
Great.
Yeah.
I also encountered some situations where, I encountered one situation that turned into medication errors. So midazolam went on shortage. The 2 milligram per 2 ml was unavailable. So a facility brought in 10 milligram per 2 ml. Now that's an orange cap to a green cap. But we know we can't trust caps, right? Cap color doesn't really say anything.
Mm-hmm.
They did send an email out to their anesthesia providers. They did not have a whiteboard. They did not have a note at the place of use, which is what I talk about, the note in the anesthesia cart.
Yeah.
So I'm reviewing charts, and I compare the chart to the anesthesia log, and I see the doc say I gave 2 milligrams of midazolam, and I see the anesthesia log say they gave 2 milliliters.
Mm-hmm.
I now know they gave 10 milligrams.
Yeah.
So I advocate for those situations a very case-specific note saying, note, this is not our normal concentration.
Yeah.
You know, use caution. This is 10 milligram per 2 ml. Mm-hmm. And really highlighting it, and again, right at the place of use.
That's a great idea, because you get, if you had the same strength for the longest time, you're just used to pulling up exactly what you pull up. And, you know, it doesn't matter if you read an email 2 days ago, once you're in that case and you're focused on that. So that's,
that's a great idea. The same atropine has run into that same problem over the past year, where the 0.4 milligram per milliliter, which is our standard drug concentration we stock, was unavailable. So they brought in the 1 milligram per mil. And it's literally a light blue cap to a dark blue. And the vials are the exact same size. Yeah. So our anesthesiologists are expected to check the concentration of and exactly what they get. And we can support them in doing it well.
So inevitably, we have to talk about the emergency cart. Because unfortunately, that's where a lot of the drugs have actually been very problematic recently. So tell us, what exceptions do we have for the emergency cart? And let's just talk through that.
It's a great question. I get it all the time. The emergency cart, I consider it to be an exception.
Mm-hmm.
I expect not to find expired drugs in my anesthesia cart, in my medication cabinet. Absolutely not. If there's a drug that they want to keep in stock anyways, it should be quarantined and really clearly indicated as expired if they're not just getting it out of the building. In the emergency cart, we have run into a lot of problems with emergency cart medicines being on back order, being on shortage, being
epinephrine
recalled.
Epinephrine,
dextrose, atropine, lidocaine, the 2% prefilled syringes, they're all having troubles.
Yeah.
So when we have a drug that is expiring and it is in our emergency cart, first thing is, are there alternatives? Let's communicate with our leadership, our anesthesia director, our consultant pharmacist. Is there an alternative? Can we go from a prefilled syringe to a vial, making sure we have the syringes size appropriate available? Mm-hmm. Something like that. If that isn't readily available, then we need to indicate that the drug is expired. Because right. the doc in the moment should be able to make a clinical decision whether to use it or not. Mm-hmm.
Well, you mentioned before we started recording, and we have a case too, where a surveyor came in, told the place, you've got expired epinephrine, you need to get rid of it. And in our case, we weren't there. and I think you just said that you had the same situation where yes, they immediately did. Threw out the epinephrine or just, you know, mm-hmm. Got rid of it. And of course, put themselves in an even more serious situation.
Sure. Yeah. Should a surgery center be open if they don't have epinephrine? Yeah. Available for a code.
Right.
It is the first drug. So, yeah. So, you know, but we should make a decision. And I'm a big advocate that it is not the nurse who's checking the emergency cart mm-hmm. who decides whether to keep it there or not. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That decision should be temporarily done by the medical director or director right. of anesthesia and then permanently reaffirmed in the governing body medical executive committee.
Well, and run it through quality improvement as an issue that you identified and needed to
do. So, you know, it should be decided by the organization, not by the nurse who's checking the cart.
Right.
And then once that decision is made, which frequently these emergency cart medications are identified as keep them in the cart. So if that's the case, then let's make sure it's labeled as expired. Mm-hmm. Let's make sure that we have it on our list of drugs that we are checking for regularly. Because the last thing you want is an expired drug that's been approved to be expired in the emergency cart, but the surveyor knows it's available.
Yeah.
And then they turn to you and they say, when's the last time you checked that one? And you say, well, it's on my back order list with the wholesaler. But then you go to the website and there it is and it's available.
Yeah.
Then you haven't been doing your due diligence. So right. make sure it's on that list that I talked about earlier mm-hmm. of things that you're checking regularly.
Right.
I have facilities that check every single day. And those backorder lists from the wholesalers, that is a backorder list that is their definition of backorder. You don't know when they're going to ship that to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But there, I have had instances where I've said to people, please bring it up. Let's look at it.
Right.
And then we looked up the drug and it was available at that moment.
Yeah. Okay.
And we put in an order, they hit send, and they got it.
And the takeaway here is make sure that you document completely what process you went through, how you tried to order it, what happened when you put that order in or tried to
absolutely
you know, get that product. Very good.
And it doesn't mean you have to submit another order every time. You just have to look to see if it's available.
Right.
Because otherwise, then when it does come available and you get 300 of them
yeah.
because they shipped all yeah. those orders that you had, yeah. we don't want that either.
Yeah. yeah.
And keep a good documentation trail, again, of the, you know, your interactions with your pharmacy consultant if you have one.
Yeah. So this is complex,
mm-hmm.
just like many other things in mm-hmm. addressing pharmacy. Things get complex. But if we put in a system in place –
right.
We keep track of things. We're watching. It does mean we have to allocate some energy mm-hmm. and some resource to it. But pharmaceuticals are a big part of what makes our surgery center mm-hmm. run.
Yeah.
You know, we've got docs who are doing incredible things, doing surgeries that mm-hmm. I, as a pharmacist, don't have anything to say anything about.
Right.
But we're also using a lot of what are considered dangerous drugs
mm-hmm.
to put people to sleep, to keep them out of pain, to treat them well, to bring them out of this surgery in the condition they were when they went in. And preparation and organization is what can make that possible.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same with regards to drug shortages mm-hmm. as it is to many other areas in pharmaceutical care.
It's been really interesting to find out how fragile this whole network is with the medications and how any little thing can really set it off. Because often you hear about the drug shortages and people think, oh, it's, you know, they're just trying to get more money or yeah. why isn't anybody making them? But like you said, it's just not that quick and flexible.
Definitely. It's, you know, I've been in the business for 30 years. This has been the worst time
yeah.
In the time that I've spent in it. Well, at least the last 12 to 24 months, it's been the worst time that we've had to go through. So definitely an area that's...
I don't foresee it going away. This is the yeah. new normal.
Gotcha.
I can't remember the name of it, but like a group of hospitals got together and mm-hmm. created a generic manufacturing company. That might solve a little bit.
Yeah.
But we need a lot more of that. We need more backup to the backup.
Right.
That's when this problem will be able to subside and getting an approved generic drug, which is what this company is going to do, mm-hmm. takes a lot of time and effort. And yeah. so they're going okay. to take the top medicines that they mm-hmm. feel as a hospital organization need and address those first. And they may help us, mm-hmm. But it's really it's not going to solve the problem because we don't know what the next drug to go on shortage is right. going to be.
Or what yeah. natural disaster is going to cause a problem in the supply chain.
Exactly.
Thanks so much, Greg. We really appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure.
So, again, we want to thank Greg for that wonderful interview. As I said earlier, he really wasn't very encouraging about the future, basically indicating that this yeah. is not going to end anytime soon. And I think he even kind of intimated that it probably would get worse before mm-hmm. it gets better.
But one of the important points he made is that you don't have to do it by yourself. Use a pharmacy consultant, and they have all that information for you and can kind of help you work your way through any of these issues.
Right. And not every state requires you to have a pharmacy mm-hmm. consultant. I always recommend that you have a pharmacy consultant, even if they're just there to answer questions for you. But when it comes to drug shortages, they have a lot of advice on alternative sources for drugs as well as alternatives to the drugs that might be on back order.
For instance, I was at one of our centers the other day, and the pharmacy consultant, Bibi, and I were working together, and she was able to look up and find the extended expiration dates for some of the medications that had expired in the cart, but that we weren't able to get in. So that was very helpful.
Right. And another important takeaway here, as we talked a little bit about, is the importance of making sure that you're doing regular reporting what's going on through the Quality Improvement Committee, and that that's reported up to the board. So especially when you're dealing with shortages, especially when you're extending the expiration date mm-hmm. on certain of the drugs, and when you have problems getting drugs that are absolutely necessary in your organization, or when you're using alternative drugs. So don't forget, I mean, I know everybody's trying to keep on top of all of that, but make sure that you also include it in your quality improvement activities and make sure the board definitely. Is fully informed about this to get you through a survey. So let's take a break, and we'll come back and talk about upcoming events in the ASC industry.
Now let's talk about some upcoming events in the ASC industry.
So every episode, we like to inform you about all the upcoming events in the ASC industry. If you'd like to have your event to be included in the podcast, please send the event information to info@ascpodcast.com.
And remember that the ASC Podcast with John Gailey is available to support your ASC association. John is available to speak, and we can record a podcast from your meeting.
Just like we did with the California Association, yeah, and now here we're out now. Here in Ohio. The Surgery Center Compliance Meeting will be held September 23rd to the 24th in Newark, New Jersey.
The Michigan ASC Association, or MASA, annual meeting will be on Mackinac Island on September 26th and 27th.
The Tennessee ASC Association Fall Conference and Trade Show is September 26th and 27th also at the Hilton Memphis in Memphis, Tennessee.
The South Carolina ASC Association Infection Control Seminar is in Columbia, South Carolina on October 5th, 2019.
And the South Carolina ASC Association's fourth quarter membership meeting is in Columbia, South Carolina on October 8th, 2019.
The Indiana Federation of ASC's Fall Conference and Trade Show is October 18th, 2019 at 502 East Event Center in Carmel, Indiana.
The New York Metro ASC and Healthcare Management Symposium is November 1st, 2019 at the Marriott Marquis in New York City.
The New York State Association of ASC's Fall Conference is in Tarrytown, New York on November 6th and 7th.
The Washington ASC Association's 2019 Annual Education Conference and Trade Show is November 14th and 15th at the Tulalip Resort and Spa in Tulalip, Washington.
And the ASCA 2020 Winter Seminars are in New Orleans, Louisiana.
And that is time to sign up for that. It's coming up soon. I know we're getting our team together to go there.
Everybody is clamoring.
I know. I've never seen people so interested in going to a conference. The Iowa Association meeting is April 17th, 2020.
And ASCA 2020 is in Orlando, Florida.
Well, that's it for this episode of the ASC Podcast with John Gailey. Join us again in 2 weeks, and please spread the word about our podcast with your friends and colleagues, and do us the honor of hitting the subscribe button.
This podcast is an educational and operational tool and is not intended to be a comprehensive resource for all the rules, regulations, and standards that an ambulatory surgery center must meet. The advice provided should not be considered as, nor does it constitute legal advice or opinion. When reviewing specific situations involving legal and regulatory issues, attorneys and other professionals should be consulted. This has been a production of Eden Group Development, All Rights Reserved. We would like to thank this week's sponsors. First, Ambulatory Healthcare Strategies, one of the nation's leading regulatory compliance and financial oversight firms. For a free consultation, contact John Gailey today at 585-594-1167 or through email at info@ah-strategies.com. And Eden Group Development, which publishes ASC Regulatory Compliance Series, the ASC industry's leading books, including the Survey Guide for ASCs, a guide to the CMS conditions for coverage and interpretive guidelines for ambulatory surgery centers, and Ambulatory Surgery Center Governance, a guide for ambulatory surgery center owners and governing body members. These must-have books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble or directly from the publisher at reg-books.com. That's reg-books.com. If you're interested in advertising or sponsoring the ASC podcast with John Gailey, please email us at info@ascpodcast.com. We would love to hear your questions and comments. Please email us at comments@ascpodcast.com.